What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Strange Familiars, covering a range of topics from the paranormal, cryptids, mythology, the occult, hauntings, UFOs, weird history, and folklore. Wherever you are listening to Strange Familiars, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or any other service, please subscribe and click the like button, and share the Strange Familiars pages and stories on Facebook and other social media. If you have experienced something strange, or if you know a story you would like us to cover, email strangefamiliarspodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook, facebook.com/strangefamiliars. And of course, you can always find us at strangefamiliars.com.
So welcome to episode 18. We're going to be talking about the Albatwitch. James is here with me, and James has a little allergy thing going on, so...
Oh my gosh, my allergies are horrible. As soon as we came back from Monster Mania last week, it hit me like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, it's bad. It seems like every time it gets warm again after it's cooled off, then it reactivates allergies.
Speaking of Monster Mania, we did Monster Mania last week.
Yes, had a blast.
3 days of meeting new folks and talking about all matters of interesting occurrences. Got to collect a lot of really cool stories, meet a lot of people, even got interviewed by another podcast while we were there.
Yeah, that was the, is it called the Poolside Podcast?
Yeah, the Poolside Podcast. And I also got the chance to bump elbows with a celebrity. Got to meet and talk briefly with Rose McGowan. Of course, I didn't have a recorder on me. But that was pretty cool. She shared a little story. All in all, the weekend was a good time. It was really great getting to like have that experience. I've never been on the other side of one of those conventions. I'm usually there hoarding movies. So it was cool to kind of be on the other side of that. On behalf of the cast, if we met you there, it was great to meet you, and we hope that if you listen to the show, you're enjoying it.
I really enjoyed it. Umpteen paranormal fest at this point. This was different. This was geared more towards horror movies and stuff. And we decided we'd take a chance, and maybe horror people like Bigfoot and stuff and paranormal stuff too. And it seems like they do. We like you said, we got a lot of great stories, one of which we'll relate because it's on topic tonight. And some other great Bigfoot stories, met some great people, just some really, really nice people. Some listeners, made some new listeners, I think. So
yeah, all in all, for sure,
it was a great time. Like you said, thanks everybody for if you came out for us. Thank you if you ended up meeting us there, and
if you ended up traveling to the far reaches of the convention and found our table. Thank you so much for doing so.
We were literally the last table there, but no, it was good.
End of the line.
But yeah, if you're a listener that we picked up at the convention, welcome aboard. Thanks for listening.
And good
thanks,
to have you.
Thanks, of course, to all our regular listeners. But yeah, let's get into Alba Twitches. So first of all, we're having the Alba Twitch Festival. That's going to be on October 14th. It's a Saturday. By the time this airs, it will be very next Saturday, in other words.
Yeah, you'll be learning about this very last minute, like.
But
we have mentioned it in previous shows, but
should be a good time. I heard on Where Did the Road Go, Soraya was talking about it. He said he's coming.
That'll be cool.
Yeah, we can have a big meet and greet there. You can meet us. You can meet Soraya. A bunch of paranormal podcasts representing there. So if you enjoyed the podcast and if you want to meet the folks behind them, if you want to meet us, come on out. Look for the Strange Familiars banner. We'll have a table there. I'm giving a talk on Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. Colin Schneider is our main speaker. We'll be talking to him a little bit later in this episode. He's going to be giving a talk on other little people, like the Alba Twitch has found in folklore throughout the world. We have other speakers. There's paranormal vendors. There's artists there. There's food, live music. Stone Breath is going to be playing a set in some form. There's a zombie.
I heard that's a really good band.
there's a zombie beauty contest. There are trolley rides. You can take a trolley ride up to Chickie's Rock, where the Alba Twitch are said to live. And, of course, this is a family-friendly event, so you can bring your kids to this. They have a little Alba Twitch thing that kids can get their face painted and put their face through the painting and get a picture of them being Alba Twitch. So it should be a great day. So come on out. October 14th, it's in Columbia, Pennsylvania. And they close the street down. They close down Locust Street. A block or two of Locust Street is closed down. And it'll be there. It'll be at the Columbia Creative Factory, and it'll be at the Columbia Historical Society. But if you come to the town of Columbia, you find Locust Street, you'll find all the events from there. I saw the t-shirts for the festival this year look fantastic. They look great. And you can get them there. After the festival, I'll have a few to sell via my website and so forth. But come on out and get the t-shirts there. They benefit the Columbia Historical Society. The whole event benefits the Columbia Historical Preservation Society. So it's a good cause.
For sure.
Yeah, and it's a great little town right on the Susquehanna River. It's between York and Lancaster County. It's on the Lancaster side. It's just a great day. It's always a great time. So come on out and see us, rain or shine. If it's raining, we'll be shoved into the Creative Factory and the Historical Society, but events will still continue. But hopefully it won't rain, and we'll be out on the street, and it'll be a great day.
We're looking forward to seeing you.
And that's in celebration of the Alba Twitch, which is our own little creature that we have here. They call it the Little Bigfoot.
Maybe you can break down for the uninitiated listeners a little bit of the history of the Alba Twitch here in Pennsylvania.
Sure. Well, let's tackle the name first, because
sure,
this gets misreported a lot. And in fact,
I've misreported it.
The information for the festival as well, they claim it comes from Apple Snitch, but it's probably not where the name comes from. They're known to steal and eat apples and even throw apples at people. So I think Apple Snitch is a good way to remember the name Alba Twitch. But I believe the name actually comes from the German. Now, this is a very German area. A lot of Germans and Austrians and Swiss German moved to this area. That's the Pennsylvania Dutch. Of course, they were not Dutch. They were German. It's just people mispronouncing Deutsch that they got the kind of anglicized name of the Pennsylvania Dutch. They were German speakers. And if you look into German, the name for elf is Alb. So to me, that almost solves the mystery right there. So it starts with Alb, the name Alba Twitch. So that's your elf. And there's a German verb, entwischen, which means to escape. And it's a particular kind of escaping. It's kind of like escaping in a smooth and gliding kind
smooth
of manner.
Escape.
So you have this Alba Twitch becomes a sort of escaping elf. The gliding thing is interesting as well, because if you listen to Bigfoot reports, a lot of people will describe it as sort of gliding across the ground, as if it doesn't even impact the ground, like almost like a cross-country skier. They'll describe the way it moves. So I found that interesting as well, that it's that particular verb, that entwition. So Albatwitch, escape elf, not apple snitch, as far as I can tell.
Sure. I believe that I had even, for a while, been correlating those two.
And for a while...
potentially improperly.
Before a German friend helped me with the language, I thought... He had told me Alb was elf, and I thought it was maybe a compound word that was English and German compound word, so it was Alb for elf and witch. So it was, you know, having to do with the reported supernatural powers of the creatures. I thought it was basically an elf witch. But when he found that verb, that entwinchen verb, it seems that's the most logical explanation. Yeah. It seems most likely that Alb is the root word, the elf. So the Albatwitch were these, or are, people are still seeing them today, 3 to 4 foot tall, very thin, hair-covered, bipedal humanoids, man-apes, something like that. And they are seen along the Susquehanna River. They were reportedly hunted to extinction in the 1800s, but as I said, people have continued to see them up until today. In fact, when we were at Haldeman Mansion, Rick Fisher told me of another sighting that he had, another report. He's taken, I think, more Albatwitch reports than anyone else. And he told me he had gotten another somewhat recent one in the 2000s, which makes, I think, about, you know, maybe 5 or 6 reports. There's not a great deal of these reports. But the interesting thing is these creatures go back before Europeans arrived here. The Susquehannock Indians had paintings of them on their shields. Now, a lot of times they say they had devils painted on their shields, but these are hairy, small little creatures they have painted on their
shields. They look like monkeys. Yeah. I mean, it looks like they had the depictions of small monkeys on the shields.
Yeah, so it's very much, we seem to be talking about the same creatures. And there was a settlement, interestingly enough, and some graves of Susquehannock Indians found, I think, at the foot of Chickie's Rock.
Right, I do believe I had read on more than a few occasions of the, I guess, remains of some structures there
and
that had belonged to the Susquehannocks.
The Susquehannock Indians, their language is lost to us, so we don't know what they called the creatures. Their mythology is lost to us for the most part. We know that they knew about these creatures, but we don't know whether they considered them animals or some sort of supernatural creature. But we do have reports of the Susquehanna, and they are reported as being these really formidable people. Interestingly enough, they said the average male Susquehannock Indian was something like 7 foot tall and incredibly muscular.
Huh.
They were known to be really fierce warriors, which is really interesting that these fierce warriors would then paint these little creatures on their shields. You know, that when you want to paint something on your war
sure.
shield, you want
oh,
something
yeah, yeah.
that's scary and powerful and brings
wolf
them
or the bear.
Yeah, and here and yeah. here they are painting these Albatwitch on their shields, these little creatures. Which does jive with the fact, I mean, a lot of First Nations people have said in regards to Albatwitch versus Bigfoot, if you see a Bigfoot in the woods, You better be careful, and you better watch yourself, and it's probably best to head on out. But if you see one of these little people, one of these Albatwitch creatures, run. Get out, and get out quick, because they're known to be ferocious. And that goes across the country. These little creatures are just said to be just ferocious.
Right. The phrase Albatwitch is something that seems to be, for the most part, part of that old Pennsylvania German, you know, coming through. Is it a term that's used in any other parts of the country that you're aware of?
No, that's completely local.
It's ours.
Yeah, and
for the most part. The creatures are spoken of, and there are stories throughout the First Nations people of the little people.
Right.
But here we actually have a name for them, where we have two different peoples that occupied the same area that were most likely onto the same creature.
Right. It seems like they're talking about the same thing. Like I said, we have unfortunately lost the Susquehannock language, so we don't know what they called them. But as far as I can tell, the Pennsylvania Dutch were reporting these things from an early time. And always around the Susquehanna River, it seems. There are a few reports that range a good way away from it, but not terribly far from the river. There's a report from the early 2000s, just outside of Red Lion. A woman observed a creature 4 foot tall, covered in gray sparse hair, with a round head. It was running through a field. She stopped and observed it for several minutes. She said it had a round head that was smaller than the head of a child of the same height. It wasn't a child, in other words. It had a head that looked smaller than a child's head would have been.
Huh.
And
it's very interesting. That reminds me of a story that we had come across the table while we were at the convention. Maybe we could get to that at some point.
Yeah, well, we're bouncing around through the timeline of sightings here.
Yeah.
Let's just hit that while we're talking about it. So
yeah.
We'll just bounce back and forth. So we're at the table and this guy comes up and we have the Bigfoot stuff prominently displayed. We've got my books there. We have the Boggy Creek print and the Bluff Creek print both there. So the guy kind of observes the Bigfoot stuff and he says, I believe in this or something like that. In some way he indicated that he believed in this. And he said, but nobody believes my story. And we said, well, tell us. We're ready to listen. So go ahead and relate what he said then.
So he sort of sidesteps to the end of the table as though like maybe he didn't want to broadcast it to everybody that was kind of hanging out at the convention. It starts kind of telling us about an incident that he had had driving. And do you remember what state that he said he was in?
It was in Maryland.
It was in Maryland. Hopefully, if he did take the card and is listening to the show, please get in contact with us because we would love to chat with you about this more so if you'd be willing to come on here and talk to us.
Yeah, it'd be a lot better to get the story directly from him.
Yeah, but to the short and skinny of it, he had been driving at night and hit what he described as what he thought to be something the size of a monkey that looked like a monkey. He thought that he'd hit a baby Bigfoot. That was, I believe, what he said he thought he had hit.
He was convinced that it was a young Bigfoot. It was bipedal, you know, covered in hair. He hit it with his car. He went back and he didn't find anything. He had no knowledge of these other creatures, that they could even exist. So when we kind of pointed out, I had some, you know, Albatwitch
prints
and t-shirts and, of course, a poster for the festival there. That was, you know, it was all news to him. He had never even considered that it could be something else. That was really interesting.
What really stood out with that brief conversation was how genuinely upset he was relaying the story. Like, I could tell that it really bothered him what had happened, what he had experienced. I believe he said he had gone back and there wasn't anything.
Yeah,
anything there.
I think he said he turned around and went back, or I'm not sure if there was a period of time that elapsed. Whatever the case, yeah, he found no trace of whatever it was.
Really, really, really intriguing story.
Yeah.
So, possible Albatwitch in Maryland?
Yeah, possible. Mm. It was near a river. I forget which body of water it was. I said, was it near a creek or a river? He said, yep, near a river. It wasn't the Susquehanna, but I forget exactly which body of water he said it was.
Yeah.
There's a really cool sighting that I found, and I can't find the source for it again. I found it before I went on Sasquatch Chronicles to talk about little people with Wes and Duke. And there's a local sighting that it was a guy relating a story from when he was a boy. And he said his brother was pinned in a tree by one of these creatures who had kind of pinned him in a tree and he was face to face with him in a very sinister kind of stance. And the boy's brother intervened, kind of ran and I think yelled at the creature or something. And the Albatwitch fled off through the trees. That was a really intense encounter. And certainly the most intense modern-ish encounter. I believe this had happened at some point in the 70s or 80s, but I cannot find the source for this report anymore. Just my notes on it. Chickies Rock has been kind of known as the home of these creatures. I always say now that, like, take it as the sort of symbolic home of them. It's not the only place they've been reported. It's not the only place they've been seen. But it is sort of the place that was known to have them. Because people would go picnicking there in the 1800s, and they report having their food stolen, especially apples. These creatures seem extremely fond of apples. Sometimes they would have the apples thrown back at them. They would be stolen and then pelted with their own apples again. So it became known to harass people at picnics. And people to this day have claimed to take apples in and have them stolen. The creatures were said to live more in the trees than on the land. So they're observed more in trees as opposed to walking on the ground. Really interesting, there's two sounds that seem to be associated with them. One is a sound like a whip, people report. I've kind of often wondered if that was maybe branch breaking. You know, people report Bigfoot snapping branches a lot as a sort of a... they think it's like a power display, like he'll just snap a big branch out of anger or to get people's attention or to say, you know, don't follow me, whatever the case. And I've often wondered if, since these are smaller creatures, if they're snapping smaller branches, then that might account for the whip-like sound, but there's often a whip-like sound reported, like a snapping whip kind of sound. And the other is whistling. I found a little bit of local folklore recently that talked about the whistle of the albatross and said if you found the right person, it was a hunter talking, and he said he knew it, and it was this very intricate whistle, and they call it a welcome whistle. And if you've found the right person to teach you this welcome whistle, you could learn it, and you could actually call the creatures out with this welcome whistle.
But that's very interesting.
They were also known to whistle and to lure people out into the woods, and it's another one of these stories where people follow the whistles, and they're never heard from again.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's very interesting. Well, there are a lot of, you know, native stories with regard to the Sasquatch whistling as well, if I'm correct.
Oh, yeah.
The whistle seems to be a theme with these hairy folks, big and tall, and short and small.
The Megamoisus, which seem to be, again, with all these things, it's hard to say we're talking about the same creature, but the Megamoisus, which are from the Northeast, I believe, and they're reported to actually play whistles, like to have actual, you know, not to make whistles with their mouth, but to actually play some kind of whistle implement. But the story is the same with them. They were luring people out into the woods, and then they would never be seen or heard from again, which ties in with the whole weird, you know, missing 411 thing and all that folklore of missing people and the fairies, you know, people going off and following them and never returning.
Well, that's something that seems to be somewhat of a common story with regard to that geography of Chickie's Rock and that Hellam, Wrightsville area to begin with. There are a lot of stories of people disappearing, a lot of weird tragedies sort of tied to that area.
Yeah, it's important to note that Chickie's Rock is directly across the river from the Hellam Hills, which we talk about with Toad Road and...
yeah, the these are very close together.
The Haunted Accomack is there. It's not worlds away from Site 7, which we keep hinting about.
Sure.
Which we have a show coming on Site 7 where there's so much there and we don't know what we're dealing with. So we're trying to figure out the best way to present that show.
Yeah.
But we have a ton of audio from one site. We've got more theories than we have answers with that. But the Site 7 stuff is coming up, folks. We're not super
extremely
far,
close.
Yeah, we're not super far from that. So this whole area is just bound up with weirdness beyond the albatwitch. Again, it's right across the river, but never have these albatwitch been reported around Toad Road or in the Hellam Hills. You get Bigfoot reports there, but the albatwitch on the York County side, the reports seem to be south of that area, south of the Hellam area, further down along the river.
I meant to ask you before, have you ever read or heard of any stories with regard to the Pennsylvania Dutch leaving offerings for the albatwitch, leaving them fruit?
I don't know if it's exclusively Pennsylvania Dutch, but often people say take apples with you to Chickie's Rock and leave them apples.
Uh-huh.
So it was almost like yeah.
That's very interesting.
Take an offering with you. And Chickie's Rock is a really weird place. Now, we did a patron episode on the River Witch of Marietta. Marietta, of course, is right there. That's just north of Chickie's Rock.
It's a whole lot of weirdness in a really small, like, sort of locale.
Yeah, and we have to talk about that because it's just too much in this one area to ignore. The area of Chickie's Rock is a very populated park. This is why I say I sort of consider it the symbolic home of the albatwitch. If it's a supernatural creature, I guess it doesn't matter how populated the park is. It wouldn't really matter. If it's a natural creature or something in between that we don't understand, the park is very populated. It's what?
Extremely populated. They have two pretty big... well, they have one really large lot at one particular spot. There's a couple different spots you can pop on at. There are two really big lots and like one smaller overflow lot. And pretty much as soon as the weather is palatable, like people are just, the place is just crowded. There's people parking like on the road, on the shoulder. A lot of people, a lot of traffic.
A lot.
A lot of folks in there at one time.
Yeah, and the park is longer than it is wide. It goes along the river for a few miles, I think, but it's only about, what, maybe 2 acres wide, something like that?
Yeah. It's not very wide at all.
There's not a lot of woods left. There are some.
There's not a lot of woods that don't have paths, like, all crisscrossing through them.
Right. So it's hard to imagine that a natural creature is making its habitat here and breeding, and people haven't completely discovered it.
That there's not sightings, like, you know, more often.
Exactly.
Like, hey, I saw something weird, you know?
These albatross sightings are very, very rare. Very, extremely rare. Much rarer than Bigfoot sightings. And there was a Bigfoot, not a sighting, but a Bigfoot encounter, something that sounds like a Bigfoot, in Chickies Rock as well. I think it was a BFRO report. Somebody was right at the mouth of Chickies Creek as it goes into the Susquehanna, and something was heaving big rocks down at them, and I think it screamed as well. Never saw it, but certainly corresponds with known Bigfoot behavior.
Yeah, for sure.
There's mystery lights associated with this place. There's tons of ghost stories. I mean, too many ghost stories to mention in one show. There's ghost stories with First Nations people. There's ghost stories with Amish people. There's ghost stories with people who got killed in trains. There's the weird ghost stories about the 10-foot, 12-foot tall mummies, whatever they were, with daggers sticking out of their head.
Which I have a theory on. Maybe that's another show.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole theory of that we have to explore.
Not to mention all of the modern-day deaths that are associated with that area. It seems like it's very few and far between that you do a whole year and not have there be some sort of untimely demise at Chickies Rock.
Both accidental deaths and suicides.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an odd place.
It really is. So, it's so interesting to me that sort of the idea of like there's this place that people are drawn to and they go hiking and they're, you know, out being in touch with nature. But it's also this place that has a lot of strangeness tied up into it, as well as tons and tons of tragedy as well. And there's just people walking and with their backpacks and their water bottles. And
worth mentioning, like, there was 7 iron furnaces within the bounds of Chickies Rock at some point. I think there were 9 total between Columbia and Marietta. 7 fall within what is now the park of Chickies Rock.
Now, are any of the foundations for those still there, or have they been pretty much erased at this point?
Quite a few of the foundations are. You can see them if you walk along, what's it called, the river trail there.
Right.
You can see them off in the woods. There is one furnace that is mostly still there. I mean, it's quite a ruin, but you can still see the shape of the furnace. And that's as you get closer to Columbia, right along the river trail.
Yeah, lots of furnaces out in that area.
Yeah, there's a really neat iron furnace museum right as you get towards Marietta on that river trail. And they have a lot of information about all the iron furnaces there. And they have, it's right across from some ruins that you can actually go over to. I think there were several furnaces and some kind of factory or something there, something to do with processing iron right there. And they have all kinds of ruins and stuff there that you can actually go through. And they encourage you, if you find slag, you can go ahead and keep the slag, if you find any slag there, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure.
I went in and was an iron nerd. I think I talked the museum guy more about iron than, you know, he's a volunteer. I think he was done talking iron by the time I was talking with him, because I've become quite fascinated with the topic, especially in the local iron industry because of Cadore's Furnace. And again, this is right across the river from all that. It's such a tightly packed area with so much weird stuff. If the river didn't separate it, it would be pretty much the same area, you know, that we're talking about here. That's how close we are.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The river's what, a mile wide, something like that?
Yeah, it's really not, it's not excessively wide at all.
Yeah, so right across from the Helm Hills, from these other things, the Haunted Accomack Inn, there's so much just packed into this one area. And Chickie's Rock just adds a whole other angle to that. And they make the claim of being the most haunted place in Pennsylvania. I think Gettysburg would argue with that, but...
I think that they would.
But lots of weird stuff happens in Chickie's, including these Albatwitch things.
Yeah, so. It's quite an array, that's for sure.
If you're enjoying Strange Familiars, if you like what we do, please consider becoming a patron. And go to patreon.com/strangefamiliars. Patreons help us make the show, and if we get enough, you're going to help us make it a weekly show. And we'd really like to bring you Strange Familiars on a weekly basis. There are many different levels at Patreon. You can go in at $3 and just get extra content. We try to do extra shows every month. This month, we should hopefully have a two-part show for patrons. If you go in at higher levels, you can get things like Strange Familiars pins, patches, vinyl stickers, t-shirts. There's all different kinds of levels if you want to support us. Again, that's patreon.com/strangefamiliars.
If you are currently listening to the show and you're enjoying it, please consider going over to iTunes. Say some nice things.
If you hit like and subscribe wherever you're listening, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, wherever it is, and if you can give a nice review, those 5-star likes, those 5-star reviews, they actually do a lot to get the podcast in front of more people.
That's right.
But however you're supporting the show, thank you very much, and thank you for listening, and we'll get on with our interview with Colin Schneider, the Crypto Kid. Tonight we're talking with Colin Schneider, the Crypto Kid. He has a show of the same name, the Crypto Kid, on WCJV. It's a radio show, but it's also available in podcast format. And Colin, your show's on weekly?
Yes, every Monday night at 8 p.m., and you can listen live at WCJVradio.com. That's Eastern Standard Time.
There was a little hiccup with WCJV. They kind of took a little break, but they're back and everything's up and running again now.
Back and better than ever.
Your show and all the others are back and running again.
Yep.
Good.
We're doing good. I'm real excited.
Excellent. And the Crypto Kid, you cover cryptozoology and related phenomena on your show?
Yeah. A lot of what I focus on the Crypto Kid is trying to take some of these weirder aspects or lesser known points of view within cryptozoology and bring them out to a wider audience while still making it really approachable for new listeners or people that aren't super familiar with the literature. I do a lot of stuff with folklore and just some weirder stuff, but I also try to stay as grounded as possible in science.
Yeah, that's a tightrope to walk.
It is.
And it's impossible to avoid the weird stuff. I have more respect for people who cover both because to me, you just can't ignore it, you know, if you're going to cover the apparent physical aspects, the footprints and the hair and the scat, and ignore the weirder stuff. To me, it just, you know, you're missing a potential part of the puzzle. Maybe they're not related, but until we know for sure one way or another, I think we have to talk about both aspects.
Sure. I completely agree.
I feel otherwise it's kind of counterproductive to the whole sort of bringing that out, you know, to an audience that needs to be presented in all of its weirdness to a degree.
If you really just want to talk about An Ape in the Woods, you know, those pesky mystery lights are a real problem, but they're there. You know, they're there in so many of the reports, you know, as part of the story, at least for now. Maybe we can separate it at some point, but for now, we're talking about multiple strange things. And tonight, we're going to be talking about little people or hairy dwarves. What's your preferred name for them, Colin?
Honestly, I like to call them diminutive humanoids the most. That's my favorite word for it. But that really, you know, turns a lot of people off because it just is very long. So I use dwarf a lot because I found going to conferences and talking about some of this stuff, if you bring up dwarves, a lot of people seem to have stories about dwarves. But if you say diminutive humanoids, they just kind of look at you weird. When I'm talking about this stuff to a wider audience, I try to keep language light. I'm not a huge fan of little people because then while there is a lot of crossover with fairy lore with diminutive humanoid stuff, it really, when you just say little people, you automatically think of the generic fairy. So I try to avoid using the term little people.
That's interesting because a lot of First Nations tribes will use the term little people, which is why I default to that, just because I've been on Sasquatch Chronicles a number of times talking about it, and that seems to be the terminology that is used from people who have taken their stories, you know, from First Nations and so forth.
That is true, but what I look at is these creatures from a larger, more worldwide aspect. And what's really interesting is when you look at First Nations legends of the littler humanoids, they do follow very closely with the patterns that we see in European fairy lore. So I think that using the little people term in that specific example is pretty accurate. I just, when I'm talking just hairy humanoids that are shorter in stature, use dwarves as a general description.
And Albatwitch are one of these. Real quick, Colin's going to be a speaker at the Albatwitch Festival. You are our featured speaker, which is really cool. And it'll be awesome to see you again and hear your topic. And your topic's going to be on these diminutive humanoids, yes?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to be speaking about. I think I titled the presentation A Not-So-Diminutive Look at Dwarves Around the World. I'm pretty excited.
That's great. And we'll be getting into some of that information tonight, but people should come out to Albatwitch Day to get a real in-depth talk from Colin on it. Are you going to be doing the PowerPoint with your presentation and so forth?
I always use PowerPoints. I think it's a really great way to get people involved, and even if they're not super into what you're talking about, they can kind of just glaze off and just look at the pictures you have up.
No, I think
sometimes they'll get some information out of it.
I think you'll find a receptive audience there. I spoke last year, and it was a great audience. I think it'll be a good day. I think you'll have a good reception. And I saw your presentation at the East Coast Paracon about a year ago now, right?
Yeah, it was about a year ago. And actually, it was a pretty similar topic that I talked about there.
I really enjoyed it, and people should come out and see Colin speak on October 14th.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
And let's get back into the Albatwitch. So have you collected any specific stories about the Albatwitch yourself?
Well, no, for a couple different reasons. First, I'm not in Pennsylvania, especially not that part of Pennsylvania. So when I bring up the Albatwitch, not many people get that connection. And if they have had encounters, they don't think about it could be an Albatwitch because they didn't encounter the thing there. Or I haven't done a lot of discussion on this topic as much lately because I've been focusing on the topic of my upcoming book that's going to happen sometime soon. So I haven't been getting a lot of reports about this topic. A lot of what I do is folklore or historical accounts. And concerning the Albatwitch, I don't have a ton because it is something that you, Tim, have been doing for a while, and I know several other researchers have covered it. So it's not something that I feel just by delving further into it and just rewriting other stories, I can really contribute a lot to it. I do have quite a few from other small little people around the world, though. Dwarves. And
these things have a lot in common. I mean, at least, like, if you look at the Megumoisus or the Puckwudgies versus the Albatwitch, there seems to be a lot of things in common with these stories that, if we're not talking about the same thing, they at least share similar characteristics, we can say.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. The Puckwudgie is quite interesting to me because there are a couple different versions of it. One that's similar to a Bigfoot description, you know, the Albatwitch, that just is kind of this hairy dwarf creature that wanders around in the woods and is seen sometimes, and it can throw rocks at people. Sometimes it's a little more aggressive. But there's also this really interesting legend, a series of legends concerning the Puckwudgies that sounds very similarly to a lot of European fairy lore. Some of the abilities that the Puckwudgies are supposed to have, they're described as only being like 5 inches tall, not hairy at all, and looking actually more or less like short humans. And they're said to have magic bows and arrows. It's just quite interesting.
Was it the Puckwudgies were said to, or I might be confusing with the Megumoisus. One of them was said to have whistles.
I think that was the Megumoisus.
And they were to lure people out in the woods. Albatwitch whistled. Now, they didn't say they had whistles, but they said they would whistle to lure people out in the woods. So you get this sort of drumbeat that goes, you know, through these different entities, for lack of a better name.
Well, the whistle's rather interesting because when you look at stories of the Agagwe from Central Africa, the whistle is said to be how these creatures communicate. And they're described almost exactly like what the Albatwitch has been described as. So that's quite interesting. And, of course, the Aren Pendek from Sumatra has had several encounters with it where the creatures were said to be whistling.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. I knew that the descriptions were kind of similar. I hadn't heard the whistling about the Orang Pendek. That's really interesting. There is supposed to be what's known as a welcome whistle with the Albatwitch. Supposedly, if you find the right hunter, they can teach you this welcome whistle, and it will allow you to call them out. This is a complex series of whistles.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That is interesting, because I've talked to several people. John Tenney is a researcher from Michigan, and he tells a story about this guy that contacted him about this elf that has been in his backyard for a while, and he has various encounters with the elf. And the elf is said to be just a short, very short, like almost only about a foot tall, hairy, it's actually hooved, little humanoid thing. And he's said to be able to draw it to where he is by singing, and that's rather interesting. I remember Tenney talked about that at the Dogman Symposium last year. That was quite fascinating.
Yeah, and this all sounds like fairy lore. I mean,
it does.
Yeah, it has its the echoes, you know, through time and through folklore from these other places. It's endlessly fascinating, and I blame you and Joshua Cutchin for getting me tied into that whole thing. No, I had some interest in it before, but you guys certainly started pointing out these, you know, these echoes through time, or this drumbeat rather that goes through it all. That's really gotten me fascinated with the idea. These little people are found around the world.
Yes.
Is there any continent that they aren't located on, to your knowledge?
Antarctica, because penguins would probably have slaughtered them by now if they were there. No, but yeah, there have only been like a handful of just any kind of strange creature report in Antarctica, and sure, certainly not any kind of mystery humanoid.
Yeah, and I mean, and that might be simply because there aren't enough people to witness whatever's going on there. So China has them. I know they're all across Europe. UK has them. Of course, in America, we have several different varieties. What I know from the First Nations people in the Southwest, I think they just call them little people, or even sometimes dwarves. And I don't know if that's an accurate translation of their native name for them. I'm not sure, but that's just what I've gotten, you know, from stories and so forth.
Well, down by Mexico, there's some fairly extensive stories of the Duende, which is really interesting because there are a couple different versions.
And that's Spanish for goblin, isn't it, roughly?
Yeah, as far as I know. And it sounds closer to actually a mischievous leprechaun in a lot of the folklore, but people report littler, hairy creatures, and they say it's the Duende.
And the leprechaun thing is really interesting because who was it? Somebody was reporting on I think a Navajo reservation, leprechaun sightings, which is just really bizarre. I mean, and that's how they were describing them. I turned up very recently from Delta some leprechaun reports, which is just south of here. It's just an odd thing, this weird stuff. It all fits together.
A rather interesting series of stories, creature name, whatever, that has not gotten a lot of attention since Ivan T. Sanderson talked about them in his Abominable Snowmen book. It's called The Little Red Men of the Delta. Kentucky, Tennessee area, kind of branched out somewhere else, but that was generally where the descriptions were. And Sanderson said the creatures were about the size of a 10-year-old child. They were covered in reddish-orange hair that was incredibly thick. They had a dark gray face, and they kind of resembled bipedal orangutans.
Wow.
And like the Albert Witch, they were said to do whistling as a communication.
Yeah, see, there's just so many common factors between these. It's hard to not to draw comparisons.
I feel like there has to be, like, very distinctly different things that are happening, because in some places we're talking about things being measured by inches, some things being measured by, you know, just a couple feet, three apples tall, you know what I mean? Or like the size of a 10-year-old. It seems like perhaps there's a lot of different things that are sort of like under that banner.
You know? Well, I think a handful of these cases. Now, I'm going to preface this with pointing out that explaining any kind of mystery with another mystery is a logical fallacy, and I try really hard to avoid doing that. But this has been brought up quite a few times, and I think it's an interesting idea that does deserve to be, you know, mentioned at least. A lot of researchers feel that these sightings of these dwarf creatures are just the young of Bigfoot. That's certainly an interesting idea, but we haven't proven Bigfoot yet, so it would be a little hard to just kind of say, well, it's got these sightings have to be its young. And also, you don't have a fairly widespread amount of sightings that follows the patterns of Bigfoot sightings. Instead, what you have is localized areas like where the Albert Witch is said to be, or where the little red men of the Delta are said to be. The sightings are consistent, but they aren't seen widespread enough to be logically, you know, baby Bigfoot.
And they're not tend to be seen with adult Bigfoot creatures.
Right.
So to me, that's a huge thing. When you see, I mean, you have these multiple reports of these small things without adults, you know, if we're to take their children, they're not seen with adults. I mean, I can't think of a case where they were.
I know of one or two, but they were never put into, you know, dwarf stuff. They were just automatically scooped up by Bigfoot researchers.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I keep thinking about the fact that, like, with fossil records and such, like, to believe that human beings as we are now would be the only kind of hominid that's here. It would make this, like, the first time ever through all the fossil records we have at this point that there was just one kind of hominid. You know what I mean? Like, it seems to me like it's not far-fetched to believe that there could be other variations or crossings of the such.
Well, something that's really interesting when you're looking at the dwarf stuff is there's actually a race of hominins that were literally called hobbits when they were discovered. And then it was Homo floresiensis. Right. And what's fascinating is
that's a fairly new, like within like the last
20 or 30 years. Yeah. But what's really interesting is every couple years, someone finds new evidence from Indonesia where they were said to be, that they were a lot more recent than we thought. And then
it starts bringing it closer.
I think the closest was like 10,000 years ago, which is not that far away.
In the big scheme of things, it's like 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Right.
The Orang Pendek remains our best chance at finding another hominid species, I think, alive at this point.
I would agree, but I would also bring up legends of the Ubu Gogo, which actually are on the island of Flores, where Homo floresiensis was first found, and they are not described as hairy. They're described to just essentially be small humans, and they're said to actually have trading relations with some of the people that live on the island, which is absolutely fascinating. So I think that it's either the Orang Pendek or the Ubu Gogo.
Yeah, I've only seen that name in print or heard it mentioned briefly. Not a whole lot of that. This is the first that I'm getting. Like I've like learned what exactly that is and where it is.
It's pretty obscure. That is really interesting. And it's unfortunate.
Well, sure. Sure, especially if this is something that's currently perhaps interacting with us and training, you know.
There are serious scientific expeditions looking for Orang Pendek. Is it this case with this other thing as well?
The Ubu Gogo, I have no idea. It really got the most attention in the 80s, but that was for like a quick second.
Right.
And then it's become very obscure.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I've noticed that in discussions of Homo floresiensis on National Geographic's news site, they bring up Ubu Gogo almost every time.
Wow.
So cool. I don't know if they've sent out expeditions, but I think that National
Somebody
Geographic
has to be digging
is,
into that.
I think it is in fact taking it seriously at least.
There is a fossil record for some kind of little humanoid, which is really puts this topic, as bizarre as it is, kind of a step forward from Bigfoot, because we don't really have a good fossil record.
I've argued for a while that Gigantopithecus does not fit.
I don't believe it does either. I really don't. It's an interesting idea, but I don't think it fits. We don't have much to go on other than witness reports, and those include behavior reports, and it doesn't act like a giant ape.
Well, not just that, but for the Gigantopithecus to have come from China and India, where it was, it would have had to cross the Gobi Desert and through Russia up through the Bering Strait. And while it was a lot calmer back then, it's been estimated that like 80% of the Gigantopithecus's food supply was bamboo, and there's not bamboo forests up there.
Right.
I just don't think it's feasible for the animal to have gone on that long of a journey.
I mean, it's a good theory, and it, you know, well, hey, we could be proven wrong.
Maybe there are parts of that theory that do hold water. I mean, the movement of people into what would become North America. I mean, it's not crazy to think that they had other, you know, there was other groups of people walking beside them as well that would have come across as well. You know, Gigantopithecus, I feel at this point. Like, I used to feel like, okay, well, that's feasible. But the more that I've learned about it, like, it feels really unlikely.
Right. And, you know, when animals do that type of mass migration, you know, humans and certain other animals that came across with us, they leave a lot of evidence.
Sure.
Sometimes even more so than when animals are just staying in the same place over a long period of time.
Sure.
So we would have a lot more evidence if it were the case.
And even in the native, what they believe is the native area that Gigantopithecus inhabited, they don't have a whole lot to work with from
right
there. They only have various pieces of skeletal framework, not a whole
jawbones and teeth, really.
Jawbones and teeth, really. And, you know,
I think
perhaps there could be a mistake in there as well. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, the area where Gigantopithecus was said to be is incredibly bad for fossils to come about. So a handful of teeth and a jawbone or two is probably all we're ever going to get.
Whether we're talking about Bigfoot or we're talking about the Albatwitch or these other various small hominids, I feel like it seems more scientifically viable with these smaller, you know, these smaller options, because we do have like a pretty healthy fossil record that this was a thing. And as time's going by, we're getting more evidence that it's closer to us than we originally thought.
If we're talking about a real creature, the caloric requirements of a smaller creature make it a lot more realistic that it could avoid us. It could stay hidden, not just for its size, but the requirements, the caloric requirements of a creature the size of Bigfoot.
It's a weird coincidence or an irony that there are so many Bigfoot sightings that Bigfoot gets top billing with a lot of the cryptid attention, but it's more scientifically viable that we have little people. You know what I mean?
Bigfoot's
of that, you know,
Bigfoot's a lot more exciting. And you know, about the caloric intake, primates need a massive amount of food because we have such large brains, and our brains have so much going on all the time that primates in the wild are basically constantly eating. They're eating or sleeping, and that's more or less all they do every day, all day. And it's insane how much food is needed to support these animals. And an 8-foot tall, even if it is a hominid, that would be immense how much food it would require.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And the other odd thing about all this is, just taking my own, like, the reports I've taken from people in my general area, and I'll just take my first book as an example. There's something like, I don't know, 50 to 75 Bigfoot reports, and I've gotten tons more since the book was published, but at that time, and I think there's like 5 Albatwitch reports in there. So much rarer these things are seen in general. And I think that goes across the board. It's much more common for someone to report a Bigfoot sighting than one of these little creatures. But yet, we have a fossil record.
The most obvious is few and far between. most obvious likelihood is the one that is the lesser known or reported.
Right? It's very strange.
It's super weird, man. It's super weird. As a lot, you know, like we were talking earlier, like, you know, just like weird just leads to more weird. It would seem.
Tune in to The Crypto Kid on WCJV. It's Monday nights at 8 p.m.
8 p.m.
And then you can catch it archived as well on their website and other places around the web. And come out on October 14th to Albatwitch Day. And Colin will be speaking.
If any of your listeners are interested in this topic, I'll be covering a lot more in my talk, and I'm going to be talking about some of the possibilities of these creatures and, you know, just connecting everything, and I'm rather excited about it because this is the first time I'm giving this presentation.
We're excited to hear it for sure.
Yeah, we will be there, and listeners should come out and see it as well. It'll be a great talk. We will talk to you again, Colin. Have a good night.
Thanks for coming on, Colin.
Certainly. I had a good time. Thanks for having me.
Strange Familiars is a production of Dark Holler Arts. Music, books, art, podcasts, and more. DarkHollerArts.com. Intro and background music by Stone Breath. Go to stonebreath.bandcamp.com for more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.